addressing hate and prejudice in Maine and beyond. Christchurch, New Zealand may be on the other side of the world, but the attacks in a mosque there feel scary and close for many people, even here in Maine. There's a sense that hate crimes around the world are on the rise. And even though that's a difficult thing to measure, many experts say they are. The FBI, for example, reported a 17% increase in hate crimes in 2017 over the previous year. Those are its most recent numbers. I'm Jennifer Rooks. What defines a hate crime or hate-related behavior? How much hate are we seeing in Maine? Is it increasing? How can individuals, families, and schools address it? We'll discuss divisiveness and how to teach tolerance next on Maine Calling. But first, this news update. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Hate crimes are prevalent around the world and are on the rise in the U.S. Today, we explore what hate and prejudice look like in Maine and what can be done to counter these forces. Joining me in the studio, Representative Rachel Talbot Ross. She is with Maine's House District 40 and has led several nonprofit organizations dedicated to social justice, including the Portland chapter of the NAACP. Senator Shenna Bellows is a state senator from Maine District 14 and executive director of the Holocaust and Human Rights Center of Maine. And Professor Abraham Peck is an adjunct professor of history at the University of Southern Maine. His focus includes the history of the Holocaust and genocide. As always, we want to hear from you. Are you aware of incidents involving prejudice or hate here in Maine? Are you involved with any efforts to bridge divisiveness in our state? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Thank you all for joining us today. And Shenna, why don't you start by helping us get a sense of what we're talking about when we talk about hate crimes or hate-related behavior? What kind of actions fall under that category?
We're talking about crimes or incidences motivated by bias or prejudice. And this is the important piece when we talk about hate crimes. Crimes that are motivated because of the person's identity, whether that is their race, religion, national origin or immigration status, sexual orientation, gender, or disability.
And what do we know about those in Maine? Is there a category in which more fall under than the other?
So what we know in Maine is that 10 agencies reported hate crimes or incidents to the FBI in 2017. And of that, we saw crimes in the area of religion. That was the largest number. Sexual orientation, gender identity, and race, ethnicity, and ancestry. And excuse me, race, ethnicity, and ancestry, there were 31 crimes in Maine or incidents motivated by hate. That was the largest number.
Rachel, I think many people would be surprised to know about the history of Maine as far as active hate groups. Can you give us a little background?
Thank you, and welcome to the listeners. What I know, and others can jump in, is a history that has existed for centuries. I would dare say that the founding of this country was a hate crime against the indigenous populations of this of the Americas, and then certainly a broader definition would be the enslavement of Africans in America. I mean, our country is rooted in human bondage and the taking of land. And stealing of land. So I think we have, unfortunately, we have a history that starts from the very beginning of which this country was founded. But moving into more contemporary, I know that starting in the 1920s, early 1920s, the very first public march in hoods by the KKK was done in Milo, Maine. And that history of white supremacy continues to this day.
Mm. Professor Peck, your work deals with studying the Holocaust and genocide. We saw the terrible shootings in a Pittsburgh synagogue last year. Do you feel that anti-Semitism is on the rise here in Maine?
Well, I know it's on the rise nationally and internationally. We have very disturbing statistics of crimes that are focused not only on the upending of cemetery plots, defacing synagogues. Sometimes there are calls into Jewish community centers, threatening bomb explosions, things of that nature. But you know, it's interesting. When Maine celebrated, or when Portland celebrated its centenary in the 1870s, there were three major groups that that were spokespeople there: the African American community, the Catholic community, and the Jewish community. And what's interesting is both the African American and the Catholic community talked about a history of discrimination and prejudice, whereas the Jewish community essentially said, you know, we're a small group of people, but we're delighted to be here, and we hope that we can find a place in Portland and in Maine without that kind of response. So I think what's happened is that I think the Jewish community has benefited from a much larger degree of prejudice against both the African-American and the Catholic communities, especially, as Rachel said, in the 1920s, but even earlier in the 1850s, when churches were burned and priests were tarred and feathered here in Maine.
Joining us on the line now, Brian Levin, who is director for the study of hate and extremism. Thanks for joining us, Brian.
Thank you. It's a Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at Cal State San Bernardino.
Okay. Your organization compiles data on hate crimes and hate groups. What do you have on Maine?
Well, our friends at Southern Poverty Law Center show there are about five hate groups in Maine, and they range from Adam Waffen Division, which is a very nasty, relatively small group, but it was responsible. One of its members is alleged to have committed a murder here in Orange County, California. So it's got a you have a mix of white nationalists and neo-Nazi groups over in Maine. Interestingly enough, with regard to hate crime, the state reports about 30, which is fairly in line with what the population is. However, we really believe that there's massive underreporting. Interestingly, Maine showed a decline at a time when hate crimes nationally were going up, but Maine also saw a decline in crime in general. One quick thing, though, since you have legislators there, it would be great if Maine could add gender identity to cover transgender people. We saw a string of homicides throughout the country, many unsolved involving transgender people, and in many of the cities, we're starting to see transgender turn into the top five in a few cities that we've been monitoring. So transgender, also the homeless. There are measures here in California and Utah, for instance, to add the homeless to hate crime statutes. Florida and Maryland, for instance, do already.
Brian, I've got a
model.
I want to follow up on a couple of things you've already said before.
Sure.
You were talking about the five hate groups present in Maine. When we're talking about five hate groups in Maine, are these people with a couple? Are these groups with a couple members, with hundreds of members? I mean, what is the scale of this?
Oh, I think with Maine, we're talking about very, very small. Here, look, even in California, when the Klan was putting together a big march, they could get barely a dozen. So we're generally talking about a smaller group. But here's the thing, and this is what I wrote about in Time just yesterday, and that is you have a population where there is polarization. And when you have that, the internet, in times of political conflict and division, can really reach people globally, as we saw in New Zealand. So, unfortunately, because of how white nationalism is now a transnational and borderless community, it's coalesced into a socio-political movement, it is now hitting places that you normally wouldn't think of. So a bomb plot in Garden City, Kansas, or a mosque massacre in Canada. That's what we're worried about. So no matter where you are, unfortunately, you will see local skinhead groups and things like that. And some of these people are getting radicalized, and they're getting radicalized at a much quicker pace than we saw maybe 10 years ago.
And I want to follow up also on, you said that you believe that hate crimes are underreported. What do you think states can do to improve data collection and get a better idea of what's happening in their state?
Thank you so much. And we did this here in California. Other states are following. We have a state auditor, but, you know, a state attorney general, whoever the legislature has tasked with these kinds of investigations, actually did a deep dive into hundreds of agencies here in California. Many didn't have policies, and many were not counting any hate crimes at all. So now the legislature is putting forth measures with respect to data collection, model policies. And I also think with a new governor, a message from the top, National Organization of Black Law Enforcement Executives found a message from the top makes a difference. So expanding your hate crime law, enhancing the penalties that you have under it, I think it's only a misdemeanor unless it's been increased recently. Also, model policies and data collection, especially from your state UCR folks, working with local departments. One last thing, trainings. And if there's anything our center can do for the police departments in the state of Maine, it would be our pleasure. Model policies, training, data collection, legislative improvements with regard to who's covered, and with respect to data collection and investigation with regard to how agencies are actually responding. We found in California many agencies just didn't even have a policy.
Thank you so much for calling in. That was Brian Levin, the director of the Center for Study of Hate and Extremism at UC San Bernardino. Thank you, Brian. Shenna, bring us up to date. What are Maine's laws? Is Brian right? Is it a misdemeanor? Do you know? Yeah, Rachel, you're nodding.
It is. Right now, it's a misdemeanor, which in Maine is a class D or E crime, depending on the severity of the crime, and it can carry up to 364 days in jail and a $2,000 fine. It's a violation of the Maine Civil Rights Act of 1992.
Shannon, we've been talking about reporting. Tell me about the Maine Bias Incident Notification Network.
So the Holocaust and Human Rights Center, a couple of years ago, put together a network of people who were interested in knowing about incidents of bias in our communities statewide, and encouraged people to report if there's an incident of bias in their community, to report to us. And then we send that out to a broad network of clergy, political leaders, nonprofit leaders, community leaders across the state. And I think one of the things that Brian said really resonated with me, and that is what we should be concerned about is not solely the hate groups and the prevalence of hate groups, but we should be concerned about the rise in online rhetoric in prejudice and discriminatory and extremist rhetoric. And we should realize that hate itself and prejudice and bias are not the sole provenance of hate groups. Each of us needs to be working to speak up, to call people out when we see that online, or to call people in. Calling in is this idea of taking someone aside and having a conversation with them when they say something that reflects prejudice or bias. Because at the Holocaust and Human Rights Center, we teach the pyramid of hate, that prejudiced attitudes lead to acts of prejudice, which leads to discrimination, that acts of discrimination lead to acts of violence, and that in its worst form, acts of violence lead to genocide.
I like that expression. I hadn't heard it before, calling in, because I think if you're calling someone out, sometimes you're putting people on the defensive and it's harder to have a meaningful conversation.
Absolutely. And one of the things that, you know, there are people that need to be called out, particularly public figures or people who are adamant in their views and clearly not going to change. And I think all of us can be good allies in calling people out when we see that. There are other people who are well-meaning, who carry residual racist, anti-Semitic, homophobic, or Islamophobic attitudes, and might say something that's deeply offensive, may or may not be aware of that, but with a good conversation one-on-one between people who care about each other, we can help change attitudes.
I want to talk about some of the news that's been discussed recently in Maine. And let's talk about those flyers around Bates College. They say it's okay to be white. I think that that was what they said, something about that. Talk about the message that sends. I mean, somebody might say, what's wrong with that?
Well, it's a dog whistle. You know, it essentially has a much deeper meaning, and it's been adopted by many groups within the supremacist, white supremacist organizations to sort of, you know, not come out directly and alienate people who might find a more aggressive message to be standoffish or insulting, or they're not happy with it. I think it's too much on the extreme. But to say it's all right to be white simply says a message, well, it's not only all right to be white. Actually, it should be much better to be white. And I think that's really the underlying issue. And why it happened at Bates College, I think, was simply because it was a reaction to the rally that was being held on behalf of the poor 50 souls who were murdered in New Zealand at two different mosques. Look, the reality is that I think that white supremacists throughout the world have thrown down the gauntlet and said, you know, we're now in the midst of, you know, not a racial war, but we're in the midst of saying that we are able to take the offensive as well as always feeling on the defensive. And I think that the shootings and murders at the African-American church in Charleston, the Pittsburgh murders, mosques that have been attacked in Canada and New Zealand, pretty much show that, you know, these groups are looking at particular groups to focus on and to say that these are the groups that are a danger to us. These are the groups that ultimately we will have to fight. And it's a disturbing situation and one of the, that I think needs to have education at all levels of our society, especially in the schools. You've got kids now who are, you know, showing Nazi salutes or are putting swastikas in the classroom, and they think it's cool, but they don't really understand the origins of that particular message. The idea of teaching about that message and teaching about the origins of hate and prejudice and of thinking that has led to, in the extreme, genocide is something that needs to be incorporated at all levels of our society.
Shanna.
Adding on to that, one thing, you know, as a white person seeing it's okay to be white, that isn't threatening to me or hostile to me. Or similarly, as a non-Jewish student, if I saw a swastika, that might not be threatening to me personally. But for kids of color, for Muslim residents and students on Bates campus, for Jewish students, those symbols have specific meanings and those slogans are targeted at groups whose identity makes them vulnerable. And I think this is a particularly important time, for example, for teachers to reach out to their Muslim and Jewish students and say, we support you, we're here, we welcome you, and offer that safety and reassurance, because these slogans and these hate symbols are targeting specific groups who feel fear and then do not feel safe and welcome in our
community.
And I
do want to talk more in the program about fear. Did you want to chime in, Rachel, before we go to a break?
No, the piece that's important to remember is that, you know, we have a national leader who is inciting this around the country. And I know we'll get to a place where we'll talk about the ways in which we can take care of ourselves and our community. But one of the obvious things is to make sure that the rhetoric coming out of our national leaders that are calling forth violent reactions in our communities is addressed and voted out of office. I mean, I think this is coming from, a couple of different sources that are encouraging people to literally incite fear in communities. And it's time that we took a stand and got rid of those leaders.
We do need to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Tandem Coffee, celebrating conversation, coffee, cheddar biscuits, and no Wi-Fi. in Portland and at tandemcoffee.com.
While the Boeing 737 MAX remains grounded, we look back at the plane's 50-year history.
It is the most produced Boeing jetliner ever. I mean, they've sold, more than 15,000 of these things since the beginning.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. How decisions made years ago to upgrade the plane could be tied to the problems of today. That's this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered is today at 4 here on Maine Public Radio. Mainers, how is childcare working for you? Maine Public News is working on a special series on childcare in Maine, and we want to know about the challenges your family has faced and how you coped with them. What has worked for you and your family? What hasn't? And what wisdom have you picked up along the way? Send your stories to tips@mainepublic.org. Leave us a voicemail at 370-3487. Again, that's 370-3487. Comment on Facebook or tweet us at Maine Public, and you might be included in the upcoming series. Thanks.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, we are discussing hate crimes, prejudice, and racism. Joining me, Shenna Bellows, who is a state senator and executive director of the Holocaust and Human Rights Center of Maine. Abraham Peck is adjunct professor of history at the University of Southern Maine. And Rachel Talbot Ross is a state representative and social justice leader. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Joining us on the line now is Kerem Durda. He is the chief operating officer at GWI, an internet service provider. He has written about his experience as a Muslim in Maine. Thanks for joining us, Kerem.
Oh, thank you for having me. Very kind of you.
And I know that I'm not pronouncing your name correctly. So tell me how to pronounce it.
Kerem Durda. That's perfectly fine.
Okay. We wanted you to call in because you wrote an op-ed in the Portland Press Herald expressing your feelings as a Muslim in Maine. And I'd like you to tell us about your experience here as a Muslim. Have you encountered prejudice?
I have in the past. I mean, being called a wetback, which is geographically incorrect, and a terrorist and so on and so forth. But yes, I have in the past. But I'm also fortunate enough and lucky that I'm part of a professional ecosystem and a group, and my social demographic standing is significantly different now than it was in the past. So I'm not subjected to those kind of quivers and arrows that I used to be. But yes, I have been.
What was your response after learning of the shootings in New Zealand?
My response?
Yes.
One of immeasurable sadness. Yeah. Yeah, sadness, very quiet contemplation, and a measure of perhaps a fortitude to do the right things the right way with the right people.
What do you think is needed to bring greater understanding of different religions and cultures here in this state?
I think there are three dimensions. One is on the business side. I think we need to do everything we can as business leaders to inculcate, encourage, and include the immigrant population, the professional immigrant population that is in Maine. It's an economically viable strata of society, and they want to contribute, and they can contribute. So mechanisms involving, equivalency of their professional degrees, being able to give them the opportunities to get the technical training that's needed, inclusive of English language acquisition, all those things need to be encouraged on a scale and a process that hasn't occurred so far. On the second side, on the policy side, I think the leadership of the state of Maine needs to essentially put the flag and say, this is what we believe in. They need to have a zero tolerance policy when it comes to nutty, crazy tweets and, missives thrown by other people and protected under the guise of free speech. And from a policy point of view, say, we want to be able to have small business loans. We want to be able to have English programs. We want to do digital certification equivalency programs for the immigrants. And then for the communities, talk to your neighbor, invite them over, share stories. Do not look at somebody else as the other that needs to be feared of. read the paper and not necessarily the nutty ones. You know, have community conversations. Go to your town hall and make sure that there's representation. Have a conversation about really tough topics. Figure out why there is such a divide in either wealth, power, or religion when it comes to extremist beliefs. That's the only way. It needs to come from the ground up. Also, as much as it is on the business side and the policy side, it takes a village to do this. It's not just one thing. You need to be intentional about it.
Thank you for joining us, Kairam. Kairam Dulerda is the COO for internet provider GWI in Biddeford, and we have posted a copy of the essay he wrote that was in the Portland Press Herald on our Facebook page. Thank you. We'll move to Susan, who's calling from Stanford. Hi, Susan. Go ahead.
Oh, hi, Jennifer. I love your show, and this is really a subject that's really close to my heart. You know, I want all your listeners to think, if the shooter had said, and I was inspired by Susan, you know, talking about the way the shooter referenced to the president, I would have been horrified. The first thing I would have been saying is, I have nothing to do with you. I don't believe in what you're doing. And that the president did not do that just proves that he is part of this problem, and he knows exactly what he's doing. And this is a horror that we have in this country. We've wondered, how could Hitler rise to power? We're seeing it, because we're seeing somebody who claims that he's not responsible for hate, and he is. And we know it, but we're not doing enough to stop him, to say that this is wrong, that we need to stand up and say no. This is too much, because he is somebody who talks about hate, and he's using this. He wants to have this division. He's thriving on it. And your last speaker, when he said it has to come from individuals, is true. And we as the individuals have to stand up and say to the people who are in charge that no more, we're not going to put up with this.
Susan, thank you so much for calling in. And Rachel, this is exactly what you were saying, correct?
Oh, absolutely. I think when you have a leader of a country that finds more pride in the rhetoric of hate than they do in bringing people together and uniting people, we've got a serious problem, and we need to replace that leader. I marveled at the way in which New Zealand was able to immediately take action on getting rid of the assault weapons and looking at the machinery around gun violence, and didn't take very long at all for them to take a stand and make sure that hopefully that kind of tragedy and violence would never happen again. So, we do have leaders all around the world that are showing us the right way to do things. Unfortunately, in this country, we do not have one.
Susan, thank you for your call. We have an anonymous question. What sorts of options are there for people in Maine to report hate crimes anonymously? I don't consider the internet to be anonymous.
I do not know of, other than through the Maine Human Rights Commission, I do not know of another place where you could do it anonymously. I think reaching out to organizations like the ACLU of Maine and the NAACP, our own Attorney General's office, I think folks would be able to let someone know what's happening. But the best way to do that really is through the Maine Human Rights Commission, in my mind.
And would you call on the phone?
Absolutely, you can call. Absolutely, you can call. Yeah.
Okay. We'll go to John, who's calling from Wyndham. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Hi there. So for about 6 months, I've been working in Lewiston. I've kind of fell in love with the community, but I couldn't help but notice, just by the nature of my work, dealing a lot with the public, that it almost seems in Lewiston that it's not acceptable, but that there's a lot of anti-immigrant sentiment in the community. And I couldn't help but think that's how incidents of hate start, when it kind of becomes commonplace and people don't really correct each other. So I was just wondering if you could talk about Lewiston specifically as a community.
This is Shanna, and I won't speak exactly to Lewiston, although I will say I was at the rally on Sunday, and there were community members, Franco-Americans, Jewish-Americans, Muslim-Americans. There were new Mainers, newly arrived immigrants, and individuals who've been in Maine for generations coming together to stand up against hate. And it was a really beautiful event. And what I think is really important is for us each to take responsibility in our own lives, in our own communities, to try to confront our own internal prejudices and biases. And I think that one of the things that Karim said earlier about representation and inclusion, if you're an employer, are you looking to hire people of color, immigrants, people of identities different than your own? If you are a teacher or an admissions counselor, are you looking to lift up students of color and students of immigrant students and be supportive? Are you taking the time to get to know your neighbor who is different than you, taking the time to socialize? If you're on a nonprofit board, are you recruiting people of diverse backgrounds to join positions of power? And I think that there are so many small ways in each of our lives that we wield influence to make our society more inclusive and more welcoming. And we cannot assume that this is the problem of one leader or one hate group. This is a shared challenge for all of us to build a more inclusive and equitable society.
Go ahead, Abe.
Yeah. So I just wanted to mention one thing, and I think all of our speakers, including the gentleman from California and Karim, also talked about the idea of the leadership at the top needing to talk about this, articulate the issues. And let me just say that, you know, I think we in Maine have lived through a couple of terms of dark times in terms of our political leadership at the top. I think we have a breath of fresh air with our new governor, and I want to tell you a little story about the new governor that relates to her family. And that is that her late father, who was in the Maine legislature, Peter Mills, was responsible really for taking measures to stop discrimination against Jews and African Americans in being prohibited from staying at certain resorts in Maine, at not being able to be part of certain country clubs or things of that nature. And so because of his actions, we now have laws that basically say to any group, organization that is thinking of continuing to discriminate, you will not get a liquor license, which, of course, is so important for country clubs and other kinds of private associations. And really, that is a legacy, I think, that our governor can be very proud of and really needs to take to heart and to use that family inheritance, if you will, to really push forward, to speak from the top, to make it known what is right and what is wrong with regard to how we as Mainers deal with each other and the prejudices that are among us.
An email from Representative Sarah Pebworth, House District 133. She writes, I've been approached by a student from George Stevens Academy who is concerned about issues along these lines going unchecked at her school. We are planning to meet. What resources are available going forward?
There are a few resources. The Holocaust and Human Rights Center has an educational program. We have educators, three, working across the state to go into schools to teach about Holocaust and human rights, both history and issues that are present in current day. There is the statewide Civil Rights Team project run by the Attorney General's office, and that is a group. Those are groups of kids in their schools working to make school more welcoming and inclusive for all, taking on civil rights issues. And so those are two resources for working on confronting bias in schools.
All right. Well, we are going to take another quick break. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do the New School in Kennebunk, an independent high school fostering innovative learning. Open house March 23rd, thenewschoolmaine.org. Cumberland Crossing by Oceanview, a new retirement cottage community proudly supporting Saturday Afternoon Opera, which airs tomorrow on Maine Public Classical. And Maine Dairy and Nutrition Council, celebrating National Nutrition Month by reminding you that dairy is nutritious, delicious, and real.
1 year after a school shooting that was threatened but didn't happen, how has the state of Vermont changed the way it approaches school security?
So there is a card scanner on the front door, and that is brand new. They put new doors in.
On Next from the New England News Collaborative, we'll look at guns, gun makers, and gun control. Plus, does a big new casino lead to more problem gambling?
So instead of maybe going out shopping, now I go to the casino.
Please join us.
That's today at 2 here on Maine Public Radio.
Depending on how you see it, Central Maine Power's proposed new transmission line to bring hydroelectric power from Canada to southern New England will boost the state's economy and help to curb climate change, or it will forever scar the Maine woods and its economy.
Sometimes I feel very angry, and then other times I just feel very sad.
Power Struggle in the Maine Woods, a week-long series starting Monday on Maine Public Radio and on the web at mainepublic.org/power.
And that will be heard next week on Morning Edition and All Things Considered on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, different options to better. Oops, we are not talking about there. We're talking about confronting prejudice, hate crimes, and divisiveness in our communities. Joining us, Professor Abraham Peck with USM, Representative Rachel Talbot Ross, and Senator Shenna Bellows with the Holocaust and Human Rights Center of Maine. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. A lot of talk, Rachel, about what individuals can do. What needs to change on a bigger, more systemic level?
Sure. Thank you for the question. I think that one of the most impactful ways for us to look at ensuring that hate does not produce inequitable outcomes is for us to take a look at our budgets, you know, what we're funding, and demand that the systems that continually produce disparate outcomes for communities are doing racial and ethnic analysis statements. So to make sure that whatever policies and practices, whatever they're funding, is not going to continually reproduce disparate outcomes. So in schools, sometimes they're called curriculum audits, where we're looking at what we're teaching, whose voice is being represented in what we're teaching. We look at suspension rates. We're looking at discipline rates. In our criminal justice system, we're looking at who we're locking up, for how long we're locking them up. And all of these things are connected. All of these things are connected. We cannot just think that the violence and the terrorism and hate is isolated. It's connected to systems, and those systems produce outcomes. So who you elect to office is really important, and making sure that we do the analysis about where we're spending our money, how we're spending our money, and all of the ways in which the justice system, the educational system interacts to produce negative outcomes.
And, you know, at the beginning of the program, we touched on this, but I want to return to it just a little bit. The whole idea of prejudice and hate being something that grows out of fear. Is this what you all believe? Is it a fearfulness among those who express hate?
Well, you know, historically, what's happened is that when there's a society that's in flux, when there's a society that is changing in a number of ways, politically, socially, economically, racially, religiously, there is an awful lot of anger on the part of those who want to keep things the way they were. You know, that's why when we talk about the issue of white privilege, it goes back to the reality that this is what this nation has been built upon. And when people look at the society that we're now creating with immigrants coming in, with gender changing in terms of same-sex marriages or transgender situation with people, it's very hard for people to focus all their energy on all of these issues at once. So they look for something that may be the basic cause of it, something that they can focus all of their worry about the change in society, their anger at the world that's being taken away from them. And so I think that in one case, at least in terms of the Jewish community in this country, which, you know, has seen 175 or 80% increase in anti-Jewish crimes, but not only here, in Western Central Europe as well. This is a historic thing. It's, I guess, called a kind of a cultural code, that when you have an increase in anti-Semitism, it's a reflection of all the other unhappinesses that people can't vent all of their hatreds across the board. So they focus on one group. And historically, the Jews have always been seen as the kind of wire pullers, you know, who are internationally involved in trying to be financial lords of the world, if you will, of manipulating other minority groups into doing their work for them. And so, you know, I think that we need to understand that we're living in this kind of a transitional society, that America is changing, that it's no longer, you know, the place where white privilege is taken for granted. And as a result, we need to understand the dynamics of how that society is changing and how we can make it change in a positive way instead of this visceral reaction of, I know, I don't want you taking away the world that I knew. Making America great again means going back to a system of segregation, of Jim Crowism, of anti-gay hatreds, all kinds of things that made America not so great. But we do have, I think, the ability, this nation, to look back at our mistakes and say we can learn from them. We can make it better. But it takes, as someone said, this village, and it should start right here in Maine. Because we're the state, the peace state, the state that stands, I think, for the kind of values that are important in our society.
We'll go to Barry in Solon. Hi, Barry. Go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, I'm also part of the Penobscot Nation. So I want to address the most overlooked marginalized group in Maine, which is my tribe, my people, the Wabanaki people right here in Maine. And address, you know, maybe you or your guests could address some of the issues they're familiar with. We have a couple of bills going before the legislature. And I got to tell you, in an attempt to get the mascots erased in Maine and maybe Indigenous Peoples Day, we've really seen a lot of pushback. And I think it highlights, you know, how Native people are fine being in Maine until we speak up. And as soon as we speak up, you know, we're a target.
Barry, I'm very glad you called.
Yeah, I just wanted to thank you for calling as well. For folks who really want to take some immediate action, there will be a public hearing on the mascot issue on Monday at the state legislature. So if you can go online at maine.gov and find out more information about it, but that bill will be heard on Monday, along with another bill. They're both sponsored by Representative Ben Collins from Portland. The other bill is around access to gaming. So both of those bills will be heard on Monday. And then next week, there's going to be a bill in criminal justice that would give a permanent seat for the Wabanaki on the Maine Criminal Justice Academy Board. There are probably over a dozen bills right now in the state legislature that look at the issues of tribal sovereignty, starting with the Indian Land Claims Settlement Act and the Maine Implementation Act. We're hoping that this session is one in which we will address the issues of sovereignty and address the issues of improving tribal-state relations.
Barry, thank you. We have a tweet from William. How do I confront the computer game service Steam, the moderators who refuse to take down racist profiles in groups. It's against their terms of service. I'm looking at you, Shenna, because your former hat is head of the ACLU and now Holocaust and Human Rights Center. This is it's a nexus of really, really two important issues.
I think it's incredibly important that you speak up and you could organize other users to contact the company. One of the things that we do notice is that corporate entities are often moved by pressure from the grassroots. And I think this goes into, systems change is incredibly important. Please come make your voice heard at the State House. Pressure your leaders to do and say the right things. Pressure corporations and schools and governmental entities and nonprofits to do the right thing. And then in our own lives, I think, Barry's comments were really compelling. Recognize that our neighbors are vulnerable when they speak up and stand in solidarity. We all need to stand in solidarity with marginalized communities. Tomorrow, for example, there's a rally in Augusta at Mill Park at 11 o'clock to stand against hate to support Augusta's Muslim community. There are a lot of different ways that people can get involved and show that support for our neighbors in our community. And I know a lot of different groups are also entering into anti-bias training. Actually, Rachel was instrumental in having the legislature do its first ever trainings, one on state-tribal relations and the second on implicit bias. And that is the type of conversation and the type of training that public officials need. At the Holocaust and Human Rights Center, we've started an Allies breakfast series for any member of the public to come to the center once a month for a conversation on how to be a better ally. This Thursday morning at 7:30, we're talking about how to be better allies to our Muslim and Jewish neighbors, confronting Islamophobia and anti-Semitism, both of which are on the rise. So there is so much work to be done, and this is a particularly important time to be doing it.
And I would just like to add to that and say that as Shenna's talking about being allies and supporting one another and collaborating and being there for one another, that doesn't mean replacing voice. Being an ally doesn't mean you replace someone's voice. It means you allow for the space to open up for their own voice and their own experience to come through. So I just want to make sure that we absolutely support get an allyship with one another, but recognize that marginalized communities, communities, individuals who are experiencing generational prejudice and discrimination and hate, they have an experience that they want to say and speak on their own terms. And being an ally doesn't mean that you then speak for them. It means you support them in speaking for oneself.
We're getting toward the end of the hour, and Abe, I know that you want to make sure you talk about an upcoming event.
Well, as Rachel said, that there is an awful lot of pain and historical trauma that goes along with being marginalized, with being really the victims of the greatest crime. We talk about what the Holocaust and Human Rights Center is doing, this pyramid of violence and hate. At the top of that pyramid is the worst possible event, which is called genocide. It's the killing of a mass killing of a group for religion, racial, gender, or whatever kind of bias. Those individuals whose families, whose communities have undergone genocide bear what Native Americans have termed a soul wound. Right? It's something that doesn't go away simply because, let's say in the case of African Americans, enslavement has gone away, Jim Crowism has gone away. It's a pain to the body, to the heart, to the spirit. And that's true for Native Americans. It's true for a myriad of communities that have undergone genocide in our world. And on April the 3rd, Wednesday, April the 3rd, from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Abramson Community Education Center at USM, you'll be able to listen to the stories of those communities who have been affected by those soul wounds. How do they deal with them? How do they pass them on to the next generation?
And we'll put information about that on our Facebook page and our webpage.
Thank you so much, Jennifer.
And thank you to all of you. That was Professor Abraham Peck, Adjunct Professor of History at USM. Also here, Shenna Bellows, Executive Director of the Holocaust and Human Rights Center, and State Representative Rachel Talbot Ross, longtime leader in Maine's social justice community. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Lucy Suchek ran the board. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Public Radio.